From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Aaron Moser.
And I'm Jared Nolan.
This week on War News Radio, Phoning Home. We hear about Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Rhodes' seven-and-a-half-month kidnapping by the Taliban in two parts.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
U.S. and Western allies launched large-scale missile and airstrikes against the Libyan government this week in an attempt to enforce a U.N.-authorized no-fly zone over the country. The attacks, labeled Operation Odyssey Dawn, are aimed at stopping the Libyan military from using violence against rebels and civilians inside the country. Conflict in Libya has escalated after troops loyal to Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi fired at nonviolent protesters in the country. Initial Western strikes were aimed at Libyan air defenses, although forces have also targeted tanks and other military vehicles. The missile attacks represent the first new major U.S. military engagement since the Iraq invasion occurred in 2003. President Obama has promised that U.S. ground forces will not be deployed in the country.
The Iraqi oil ministry has released an ambitious new plan to increase Iraq's oil production. Iraq currently produces about 2.6 million barrels a day, and the proposal sets a goal of producing about 6.5 million barrels a day by the end of 2014. The new oil production plan was shaped by several new agreements between Iraq and different international companies to upgrade Iraq's largest oil fields. Iraq has access to the world's third largest proven oil reserves, estimated at 143 million barrels. However, continuous instability in Iraq has hindered development of oil production capacity. Many critics of the proposal believe that Iraq's new goal is unrealistic, given that Iraq and even its international partners will be frustrated by weak infrastructure and the unpredictable political climate.
Mobile phone companies in the southern Afghan province of Helmand have disabled service in response to Taliban threats of violence. The Taliban have claimed they will destroy any functioning mobile phone technology that companies do not shut down on their own. The organizations fear that NATO forces can track their movements through mobile phone signals. The Taliban's threats will have serious consequences, since mobile phones are a primary means of communication in places like Helmand. Landline service is widely recognized as unreliable, and Afghans do not use it as commonly as mobile phone services.
NATO announced that one of its helicopter gunships killed two civilians while attacking suspected insurgents in Khost, a province in northern Afghanistan. According to NATO, two civilians were walking near the targeted vehicle, and coalition forces did not see the civilians prior to beginning their airstrike. Accidental civilian casualties due to military operations are a continuing source of tension between Afghan citizens and international forces.
One of five soldiers accused of murdering Afghan civilians for sport early last year has been convicted and sentenced to 24 years in prison. Specialist Jeremy Morlock pled guilty at a military tribunal in Joint Base Lewis-McChord near Seattle. In exchange for a relatively light sentence, he agreed to testify against his fellow soldiers. Morlock said that the group would fake combat situations using grenades and rifles, then rearrange the bodies of harmless civilians to make them look armed. His Army Striker Brigade became infamous after pictures surfaced of the soldiers standing gloatingly over corpses. During the trial, an expert sociology witness testified that brigade leadership fostered dysfunction and created an environment that led to these crimes. Then Brigade Commander Colonel Harry D. Tunnell was removed from command last fall.
This is War News Radio. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Rhode was kidnapped in November 2008 by the Taliban. He and his wife, Kristen Mulvihill, photography director at Cosmopolitan magazine, recently chronicled their experiences with the kidnapping in the book A Rope and a Prayer, a kidnapping from two sides. In two parts, we hear from Rodin Mulvihill about his 7.5 months in kidnapping, the emotional and psychological aspects of the situation, and the resulting insight to the most powerful faction of the Taliban. Eliana Biskard Church has the story.
The driver punches the accelerator, and we cross into the open desert. The gunman in the front seat aims his Kalashnikov assault rifle at us. No one speaks. I glance at the bleak landscape outside, reddish soil and black boulders as far as the eye can see. I fear we will be dead within minutes.
That was David Rode, a 2-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. When in Bosnia covering the Srebrenica massacre, for which he earned his first Pulitzer Prize, Rode was captured and held for 10 days. 13 years later, in November 2008, he was captured by a much different group, the Taliban. His work with the New York Times covering Afghanistan and Pakistan, for which he won his second Pulitzer in 2009, had not prepared him for this. His life, and that of his wife of only 2 months, Kristen Mulvihill, was thrust into chaos.
I had been covering Afghanistan for the New York Times since 2001, and I had actually gone on a book leave and was working on a book about the American effort to stabilize the region and sort of what had gone wrong. And on this last trip, it was the fall of 2008, and I was shocked at the sort of strength of the Taliban resurgence and how popular they seemed to have become with people there. So I felt for the book to be as accurate and thorough as possible, I should really have a Taliban character. And I had heard about this Taliban commander who had given interviews to 2 foreign journalists before. I met with a foreign journalist who had interviewed him actually twice, and she said, you know, you are more dangerous than an American, but I don't think he'll kidnap you. And off we went to the interview, and unfortunately it was all a trap. When we arrived at the meeting point, we were nearby. We were told to keep driving down the road, and then nearby we were abducted by Taliban gunmen. And that was the beginning of our 7 months in captivity.
David had just gone back overseas, as he mentioned, to report on his book, and I just started a job at Cosmopolitan magazine as the photography director. So our daily environments were very different and the content we were dealing with. And I found out about the kidnapping at work, actually.
Rode writes in his book that he thought they were about to be killed at that moment. Little did he know that they were to survive and stay in captivity for the next 7.5 months. Rode was captured with his driver Asadullah Mangal, and translator Tahir Ludin, by a man who called himself Atikola, a name the three would later learn was an alias for Abu Tayyeb, the Taliban commander Rode thought he had arranged an interview with. Back in New York City, Mulvihill was plunged into disarray when she heard of the kidnapping.
David's brother Lee called me and said that David hadn't returned from his last interview. And right away I was sort of thrust into this other world. I tried to gather myself and just kind of ran home and had to go actually up to New England to meet with FBI agents there. And then the following day went to meet with editors at the New York Times. So it was a real whirlwind of dealing with different organizations. I was trained by the FBI to expect calls at some point from his captors. So I was trained to sort of extend call. All our phone calls were recorded. I also met with State Department officials with my brother-in-law, Lee. We tried to do everything we could as a family. We wanted to feel like no stone had been left unturned.
It turns out that Rode had been captured by the powerful Haqqani network within the Taliban, which operates in Pakistan and Afghanistan. The network began as the militant Jalaluddin Haqqani rose to power fighting the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan in the 1980s. The U.S. also funded the Haqqani network in their opposition to the Soviets at the time. The group was the first and strongest backer of Osama bin Laden. Today, Jalaluddin's son, Sirajuddin Haqqani, leads the network based in North Waziristan, Pakistan, where Rode was held captive. Sirajuddin led the kidnapping of Rode in order to make money, asking initially for a ransom of $25 million and 15 prisoners from Guantanamo Bay. For this reason, Rode believes, they did not abuse or become violent with Rode and treated him relatively well.
I think it was primarily greed. And, I was lucky in a sense that they had me because they wanted money. I had a sense that the commander who kidnapped me, he reminded me of sort of a young capo in an organized crime family who was trying to use my case to make his name. There was lots of determination to try to get more prisoners and more money than had been received by another Taliban commander. They saw me as worth a lot of money, and that's what kept me alive. And I was lucky in that sense.
Through living with the members of the Taliban, Rode witnessed an inside view into their extreme ideologies.
One of the ironies of my case is that in the 1980s, the father, the sort of patriarch of the family, Jalaluddin Haqqani, he brought Congressman Charlie Wilson. Congressman Wilson was a Democrat from the Houston, Texas area who funded the anti-Soviet Mujahideen. And the Haqqanis brought Congressman Wilson in, gave him a tour of their efforts to fight the Soviets, and actually let Congressman Wilson fire a few rockets at a Soviet base. And Wilson was so impressed and so delighted that he referred to Jalaluddin Haqqani as, quote-unquote, goodness personified. A few decades later, Jalaluddin Haqqani's sons kidnapped me and said that as an American, I was their mortal enemy. So this militant Islam that we favored when it was used to kill young Soviet soldiers, you know, has sort of turned into this Frankenstein that's come back to haunt us. And people, again, say, why do we care? It's not our problem. We have some role in creating this mess, and it is a direct threat to the United States. And there are plots against the U.S., you know, made in these tribal areas of Pakistan. So for those reasons, that's why I think we need to, again, find ways to kind of effectively help local moderates counter the extremism there.
The extent of the extremist Taliban ideology and propaganda was shocking to Rode, and he was also surprised by the fact that the Pakistani military did so little to combat the Taliban.
And I think the extent of how hands-off the Pakistanis were towards the Taliban really shocked me. My guards took bomb-making classes at one point every day in this large town, Miran Shah. It's the largest town in a place called North Waziristan. And they would set up these enormous explosions in the middle of the town. And there is a Pakistani military base in Miran Shah, and the Pakistani soldiers never came off the base to investigate what was happening. The Haqqanis were so confident of their control of North Waziristan. It's a Taliban mini-state that's, you know, thriving there today. Faisal Shahzad, the young man that tried to set off the bomb in Times Square last year, he was trained in North Waziristan, and so was Najibullah Zazi, another young Afghan-American who he was planning to set off a bomb in the subways in New York City. Also trained in North Waziristan. So it's astonishing and sort of really distressing to me that the Taliban mini-state there continues to thrive.
While engulfed in this world of extremism, both Rode and Mulvihill experienced ironies. In captivity, Rode's captors would on one hand make him watch Taliban propaganda DVDs glorifying suicide bombing and desensitizing viewers to American deaths with graphic footage, and on the other hand would make him sing songs like The Beatles' She Loves You at night when they were bored. Meanwhile, Mulvihill straddled the American fashion world, at the same time receiving phone calls from the FBI, State Department, and Taliban in her New York City office.
And the one thing I felt was very ironic, like in my experience with talking to his captors, there was a moment where, you know, I was always told to say I was praying for David because they would relate to that. And I was, you know. And at one point I said to them, you know, I'm praying for all of you. And their response was, God bless you. And it was kind of funny, but it's sort of the one thing we might have in common as a belief in something else. And yet it gets turned into this battle, which is unfortunate.
Coping with the kidnapping was truly an exercise of will, determination, and faith for the couple.
For me, family support was tremendous. For my brother-in-law, Lee, from David's family, my mom came in and stayed with me. I continued to go to work. You know, in midday, I'd have an update from the security team in Kabul every day about what was going on or wasn't going on with his case. Also, I talked to former hostages, which was very helpful. It's a very isolating experience, and to know someone else that survived similar situation was tremendously empowering for me. And faith played a large role for me as well, and just kind of surrendering to a higher force and believing something would look out for him.
And for me, you know, I sort of thought it was my job to just kind of get through the day, and it was basically my job to survive. I knew that Kristen and my family and my colleagues at the paper would be doing everything they could to help us. So I just really felt like I had to kind of keep my nose down and do whatever I needed to do to survive. And I had little things I did every day. I had chores. I had things that they gave me to read. I listened to the BBC a lot. I was treated very, very well during our captivity. I was never beaten. They actually gave me bottled water every day, and they called me the golden rooster, expecting me to lay a golden egg in terms of a large ransom. And I did have a set of prayers, I said, and they were very informal prayers that I just sort of made up. essentially praying that, you know, no one would die, praying that my family wouldn't worry so much. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of skeptical of organized religion. I've seen religious extremism. I've seen Christian extremists in Bosnia do horrible things, Hindu extremists in India do brutal things. And these were Muslim extremists that kidnapped us. But I don't know if prayer for someone, you know, if there actually is a God who hears you when you pray, or if it's just sort of a psychological trick, you know. But it, when you're in that kind of powerless situation, I did find that saying these prayers leave me more sort of calm and centered every day.
7.5 months is a long time to remain calm and centered. After the break, we'll hear how they fared, the lasting effects of the kidnapping, and the political implications of this unique look into the Taliban.
This is War News Radio. In our first segment, War News Radio heard from Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Rode, kidnapped by the Taliban in the fall of 2008, and his wife, Kristen Mulvihill, on their experiences during the beginning of Rode's captivity. Now, Eliana Bisgard Church takes us back into the story, how they managed till the end of his kidnapping, and the political implications there may be from their experiences with the Taliban, Pakistani, and United States officials.
Mulvihill and Rode employed all that they emotionally, physically, and spiritually could during Rode's captivity, taking a large toll on them both. Mulvihill had to take a leave of absence from Cosmopolitan magazine as she turned to focusing on Rode's case fully. She met with U.S. officials, including Richard Holbrooke, who was the special envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan at the time, and their largest ally in the case. Carl Eikenberry, ambassador to Afghanistan, and Hillary Clinton, as well as with Pakistani officials. The U.S. government does not pay ransom, nor does it release prisoners, the two rewards the Taliban demanded, and so Mulvihill was caught in a battle of negotiation, much on her own, despite her use of private contractors and her U.S. and Pakistan diplomatic efforts.
Actually, our case spanned the Bush and Obama administrations. There wasn't a tremendous amount of difference between the two or in terms of what they were each able to do, except we had a very important advocate, Richard Holbrooke, in the Obama administration. But it didn't seem like the diplomatic approach helped with us trying to negotiate or spark communication. So that was frustrating. And I kind of realized, or I felt all of our efforts or outreaches to our government, to the Pakistani government, none of it was really having an impact. And I had spoken with Alan Johnston a few months prior. He was a BBC correspondent who'd been held in Gaza. And he had said to me over the phone that, you know, you have to accept that the outcome isn't necessarily going to be up to you. And that, in a sense, actually, you know, kind of took some responsibility off of me. It was hard to accept that in the initial months, but I really came to realize that 6 months into it, when, you know, it didn't seem like we were making any progress, there was another long period of silence. And I really sort of decided, you know, to continue to pray and whatnot. It was a way to surrender without giving up.
Meanwhile, the stress was adding up on Rode as well. He and Tahir and Assad had been located in Miram Shah, the stronghold of the Haqqani network, and his captors had continuously promised and then retracted their release to a point where he felt hopeless in his ability to negotiate with them and return home.
I had really come to just utterly despise my captors. I saw them as criminals masquerading as this pious religious movement. I saw them as it's a really personal crime, kidnapping. Essentially, people are – it's a crime against your family almost more than anyone else. Your family is made to feel like if they could just come up with this money, you know, and they were demanding $25 million and the release of 15 prisoners from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and that was just absurd, but they just insisted that's what they wanted. And by the time we escaped, the demand was down to $7 million and four prisoners. And I was really disgusted with them, told them a million times my family didn't have that much money. So it was really a mentality of wanting them to get nothing. We knew maybe we had a chance to try to escape because we'd been moved close to this Pakistani base. And I just thought we should try while we could. And I never thought, you know, it would work.
One Friday night, after 7 months and 10 days in captivity, Rodin Assad escaped.
I literally tried it because I thought I would feel better the next day for having, you know. And what we did was we basically got out of this house, used a car tow rope I'd found to lower ourselves down a wall, all while the guards were asleep in the middle of the night, and then arrived at this Pakistani base. And even when we got to the Pakistani base, the guards there nearly shot us because they thought we were suicide bombers. We lied on the ground for 10 minutes, and then finally we took off our shirts to show we didn't have suicide bombs, and they let us inside. And then there was this extraordinary young Pakistani army officer, Captain Nadim, who apologized to me for our kidnapping, said he was vehemently opposed to the Taliban, felt that they had distorted his faith. And most importantly, he let me make a phone call to New York. And if he had not done that, we were afraid no one would find out we had escaped. We were afraid other Pakistani officers might come who were sympathetic to the Taliban and they would simply hand us back. So this young, moderate Captain Nadim saved my life, and I want to talk about him as much as I do my kidnappers. There is this other side to Afghanistan and Pakistan. They are the majority. I'm still in touch with him. And he's an incredibly brave man who said he just felt terrible for us and saw us as human beings. And, you know, he was happy to help us. And we were incredibly lucky he was on duty that night.
The Taliban mini-state is exceptionally strong in North Waziristan particularly. Rode further emphasized that moderates like Captain Nadim exist in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and that any solution to a stable government and region lies with the United States and allied forces supporting the less visible moderates.
Most Afghans and Pakistanis see the Taliban as extremists. They're very unpopular. They have a very distorted view of Islam. Recent UN reports talk about 70% of the civilian deaths in Afghanistan being from Taliban. Afghans see that it's indiscriminate bombing. There's also a lot of resentment towards the U.S., but I guess I just want to say to people that being anti-American doesn't necessarily make you pro-Taliban. Mm-hmm. Most Afghans and Pakistanis are looking for sort of a third way. They don't want to be kind of American pawns. They also don't want, you know, the Taliban to force them to live at gunpoint under this extremely harsh and strict and sort of distorted interpretation of Islam. And we have to, you know, figure out how do we empower those moderates kind of in Afghanistan and Pakistan more consistently and sort of effectively, and particularly over the long term.
Rhodes' experience taught him much about the Taliban, and he believes investigating the various relationships in Pakistan is the key to understanding the Taliban's strength.
The Taliban have a safe haven inside the borders of Pakistan, all the tribal areas as I talked about, and this is the key thing that gives the Taliban their strength. The Pakistani military is not aiding our effort in Afghanistan. We're giving them $2 billion a year in military aid, and they continue to allow the Taliban to have the safe haven. And as long as that safe haven exists, I don't think the U.S. effort in Afghanistan will succeed. So pressuring the Pakistanis is, I think, vital if this surge is going to work. The most important thing, I think, for readers to understand about what's happening in Afghanistan is that, in a sense, rivalry between India and Pakistan is playing out on the ground in Afghanistan with American troops, in a sense, caught in the middle. The reason that the Pakistani military is allowing the Taliban to sort of have shelter inside Pakistan is that the Pakistani military sees the Taliban as these very valuable proxies they can use to reduce India's influence in Afghanistan. There's a real fear among the Pakistani military that India is trying to take over Afghanistan. That would allow India, in a sense, to surround Pakistan. I think those fears are exaggerated, but it's interesting. There's a WikiLeaks cable where the U.S. ambassador in Pakistan points out that no amount of military aid is going to break this tie between the Pakistani military and the Taliban, and that the U.S. actually had initially encouraged India to be more active in Afghanistan after 2001. And again, we just sort of, you know, are thinking too much in the short term and not understanding the region. That increased Indian involvement just sort of played on Pakistani fears. So a key thing is to try to reduce tensions between India and Pakistan.
Rhode escaped from this Taliban stronghold and was reunited with Mulvihill in the Dubai airport after 7.5 months of separation.
I was speechless. There was so much to say to him. He also looked just like himself. You know, I had no idea what to expect. I didn't know if he would have lost a ton of weight, things like that. But he looked like David. And so that was somewhat surprising as well. And, you know, he came running towards me and A big embrace.
Oh, she looked beautiful.
So you hadn't seen a woman in 7.5 months.
No, there was lots of women in the Dubai airport, and she looked beautiful.
That's true.
But it was, you know, I was just, it all seemed like a dream, actually. Yeah. And the first few days, I actually woke up, and the whole thing would be a dream. This whole escape wasn't real. You know, we're just incredibly lucky that our case ended that way. And, you know, I'm just incredibly lucky to have fought so hard to, you know, save us and bring us home.
No, and I think the fact that he kept his wits about him, and for what he thought might be the right moment to escape, I think that's a testament to his strength, too, and his character.
Through their book, Rode and Mulvihill hope that their experience will help others in similar scenarios.
You know, our situation's extreme, but we hope it resonates beyond kidnapping. If someone's dealing with life and death situation where they have to make perhaps, you know, medical decisions for a spouse or things like that, just any situation of separation or uncertainty, we hope it is somehow helpful to them.
Their book may have an increased audience. 145 journalists were imprisoned worldwide in 2010. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Four of Rhodes' colleagues at the New York Times were recently captured in Libya, though fortunately they were released 6 days later. Rhodes speaks about the rising safety issues for journalists and how they address the question of continuing potentially dangerous stories with concern.
You don't really know, and I don't think there's any formula. You know, you just don't know when something's going to go wrong. It's almost a numbers game. And you know, my colleagues that and myself talked about it, and we do. We feel like, you know, eventually something's going to go wrong no matter how careful you are. So the odd thing about today is I think it's there's more kind of punditry and opinion than ever in the media. And getting out and reporting on the ground and getting what journalists call ground truth I think is more important than ever, where you actually can talk to people, see with your own eyes what's happening. So that's more important than ever. At the same time, it's more dangerous than ever to go get that ground truth. I think journalists have kind of lost a lot of the neutrality they enjoyed in the past. People just see journalists as targets or as victims they can just grab easily, and whether it's criminals or governments. So it's a frustrating problem, you know, and I applaud the people that are still out there trying to get ground truth.
Luckily for Rode and Mulvihill, their story is a happy one. Rhodes' days as a war correspondent are over, but he continues to work for the New York Times as a member of the investigative unit. He has been tracking the Mubarak and Gaddafi family's money, still making an impact from New York City, as he said. Mulvihill has returned to work as photography director at Cosmopolitan magazine. For War News Radio, I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can find us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Amandine Lee, Rosanna Kim, John McMinn, Louis Katz, Alan Zhao, and Christina Matamoros. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Aaron Moser.
And I'm Jared Nolan. Until next time, thanks for listening.